Welcome to With All Due Respect, the podcast that speaks to you, and you better listen. Okay, let me tell you something. More than one person has wondered what happened to me in the last scene of The Sopranos. So I'm here on Andrew's podcast to finally let the world know what happened to Tony Soprano. I got tired of the cold weather and high taxes in New Jersey and moved to Jamaica. That's it. Now get out of here and listen to this episode before you start asking too many questions.
It's the politics segment, and I'm just getting warmed up. I know who used to lead this place. William Egan, Walter Hickel, Jay Hammond. Their spirit is dead. It's gone. Replaced by greed and lack of leadership. If I was half the man I was 5 years ago, I'd take a flamethrower to this place. Hoo-ah!
In our politics segment, I am flying solo. And I would like to take this opportunity to talk to you about power and responsibility. In Alaska, where the governor by constitution has a tremendous amount of power already, the effects of it being wielded carelessly or ideologically can have devastating effects not just on democracy, but the health, education, and welfare of all Alaskans. Over the last 6 years, Governor Mike Dunleavy has wielded his power in that exact fashion, both carelessly and ideologically. From attacks on free speech rights of state employees, unions, attacks on libraries, to attacks on the right to privacy, which is specifically guaranteed under Alaska's constitution, I might remind you. Governor Dunleavy has consistently wielded his executive power like a sledgehammer in an ivory shop. In fact, his sledgehammer is so damaging it could cost Alaska $4.6 billion in construction funding after his transportation proposal was rejected by the feds because he insisted on trying to use his power to force transportation projects on communities without giving those communities any local input. Now, recently, he was asked at a press conference by a reporter, "Yo, bro, why would it be so good to concentrate so much power in the executive branch?" And the governor's response was, quote, "It'll help streamline the process." And so when the reporter followed up with, "Okay, but still, why shouldn't the Senate and House be able to appoint members of committees that have a direct economic and social impact on their communities? I don't know, like the Alaska Marine Highway System?" And then Governor Dunleavy said the quiet part out loud. Dude said, and I quote, "If they're at odds with the DOT commissioner or the executive, we might not be able to fix the problem." Okay, so we've established that in Governor Dunleavy's mind, the only way to fix government problems is by silencing the opposition. I mean, who the hell is this guy, Tony Soprano? And look, I know Tony Soprano, and Governor Dunleavy is no Tony Soprano. I mean, that is as anti-democratic of a response as you can humanly give as an elected official. But here's the thing. While Dunleavy is breaking things left and right, the one thing that's being missed in all of this is how after he consolidates all of this power in the executive branch, he is resting that power in the hands of a labyrinth of state departments who are both drastically understaffed and underfunded, along with boards and commissions that are staffed and run by unqualified and partisan political appointees. And what makes me laugh and cringe at the same time is when Governor Dunleavy in that press conference tossed around terms like streamline efficiency and operational integrity. Because from a streamline and operational integrity standpoint, you are resting the public's future in the hands of unelected, underfunded, and understaffed political appointed employees to carry out the direction of unelected and unqualified political appointees. And neither one of those groups are responsible to the public. Look, ladies and gentlemen, this is Governor Dunleavy's last 2 years. He is not governing the state. He is trying out for a job with a potential Trump administration. He will continue to play his fiddle while lighting the state on fire. Power and responsibility. wielded carelessly and ideologically.
In our life segment, in the heart of the urban jungle of Anchorage, Alaska, there is but one man who can navigate the history of a town embedded with contradictions. From Grizzly Burger and Clinker Daggers to the Sundowner Drive-In Movie Theater, only one man can separate fact from fiction when it comes to the history of Anchorage life. Mr. David Reamer.
In our life segment today, a very special guest, and he will become a reoccurring segment on this program because if there's one thing we love, it's Anchorage history. Today, as a special guest, we welcome David Reamer to give us the history of drive-in movie theaters in our beautiful city of Anchorage, Alaska.
Among all the lower 48 cultural phenomenons that have been recreated, dragged up to Alaska, few have been more surprising than drive-in theaters, most especially in Anchorage, a city of notably short summers and long winters, that at one time in the early 1970s somehow featured three drive-ins. Now, these places, they were often cold, they had bad movies, bad speakers, bad screens, but they remained a defining memory for a generation. The first of these was the Billiken, opened by Ed and Marie Hanby in September 1963 on Muldoon Road, where the Regal Totem is today. And the first films shown were the 1957 Jet Pilot, starring John Wayne as a titular flying hero, and the 1961 Blue Hawaii, an Elvis Presley vehicle. These were the types of movies made for drive-ins, broad, easily understood or laughed at concepts, the sort of movies you could enjoy but maybe ignore if you had something better to do at your time at the drive-in. However, the Hambys struggled to obtain quality movies. The company that controlled the other first-run theaters in town, Lathrop Co., conspired with film distributors to block the Billikens' access to better movies, leaving them with lousy old pictures that nobody else wanted. For their first Christmas Day matinee, Christmas, the theater showed A Summer Place, which the New York Times described as garishly sex-scented, and the 1963 Operation Bikini, which indeed featured mini bikinis, somehow intercut with war scenes. And while these films were tame by modern standards, the Billiken was soon showing outright adult fare, with titles like The Pleasure Machines, Love Camp 7. And as many old-timers attest, you could see the screen from the road, although all these virtuous sourdoughs have sworn to me that they only snuck a glance. In 1969, Alaska state troopers confiscated two adult movies there, claiming they contained, quote, scenes which glorify lustful conduct and human brutality. Hanby was convicted on 5 counts of contributing to the delinquency of a minor, though the Alaska Supreme Court overturned the conviction. In 1966, the Lathrop Company opened its own direct competitor with the Sundowner Drive-In, off Seward Highway a little north of Fireweed Lane. It featured a more central location, free car heaters, and windshield washing, which the Billiken charged 50 cents to rent a heater. The stated dream of both theaters was year-round operation, but reality very cruelly intervened. When it got too cold, the exhaust from the cars in front of you could block the view. And those little heaters, whether you paid for them or not, provided by the theaters, when they worked at all, were just incapable of warming up a full car on a frigid night. By the 1970s, both theaters closed in January and reopened in March or April whenever things got warm enough. The third drive-in in Anchorage, Cinema 360, opened in August 1972 at Seward Highway in Huffman, what is now a Cars. Rather than the traditional parking lot layout of other drive-in theaters, Cinema 360 was the new deal in drive-in theaters, and very quickly not a deal at all. They arranged cars in a circle facing outward, each facing an individual back-projected screen with sound played over an AM radio station, and the restrooms and concessions were located in the center of the circle. None of these drive-ins were profitable. When they could, the Billiken and Sundowner tried to fill their daytime hours with warm-up acts, teen dances, concerts, the most infamous being a 1970s show that featured a pre-fame and, according to some local critics, pre-talent Kiss. Nor could the influx of money and residents during the 1970s save the drive-ins. Cinema 360 closed in 1973, just over a year after opening. The Billiken limped along with its new management before closing in 76. And the Sundowner closed for good in January 1979. Its final feature was the musical Grease. Drive-ins in Anchorage had taken the residents from John Wayne to John Travolta before disappearing. An indelible memory for those that experienced it, and an unimaginable bit of trivia for anyone who came later.
And what's cooking, Doc? Now, wasn't that a great episode? Now, we're at the point in the podcast where Andrew gives his closing comments. Wait a minute. Is this thing over?
Yeah, what's the big idea? I got something to say here.
Suffering fuckatash. I'm with those guys.
Yeah, right. Take it easy. After the closing comments, you'll have the entire rest of the show to talk all you want.
Thank you, Mr. Wilder.
What a bunch of maroons.
In closing comments, how 50 Cent made me realize that Governor Mike Dunleavy was going to veto over half of the historic education funding increase. This morning, on the way back from an SBDC conference, and that means Small Business Development Center conference, where I sat on a panel discussing AI and its effect on political campaigns, side note, I love John Bittner and Gretchen Fauske. I love them both, and I love the work they do on behalf of small business and this state's economy, and I think they are both just incredible people. Okay, moving on. All right, here I am. After the conference, I'm rolling back to my office in my car, and my playlist kicks up what? But 50 Cent, Da Club, right? Da Club, 50 Cent. We all know Da Club, right? He's going to be in Da Club with a bottle full of bub. However, if you listen to the lyrics, it's very clear that 50 Cent, he ain't frontin'. No, he ain't frontin'. This is where he is. You looking for me? Here I am. I am in the club. I am in the club with a bottle full of bub. So that means that when people tell you where they are, I mean, believe them. Why wouldn't we believe 50 Cent is in the club? That's why 50 Cent convinced me that Governor Mike Dunleavy will veto 56% of the proposed education funding increase. All right, let's start at the beginning. Last month, the legislature passed a historic education funding bill. Both bodies of the Alaska State Legislature passed overwhelmingly, the House 38-2, the Senate 18-1. However, one of the things that I was surprised about was how fast the House majority gave up and rolled over, especially for a bill that was so far away from their initial offer. Now, we have to remember, there are two important parts to this bill. There's the policy part, right? And then there's the appropriation part that has the cash money. Now, the feeling is that Dunleavy will reduce the $680 per student increase down to $300 per student. And of course, remember, you need 3/4 vote for an appropriations override. So that means Governor Dunleavy only needs to find 15 no votes to basically protect him from a veto override. Now, enter my representative, Sand Lake Representative Tom McKay. When I was in his office last month, I quizzed McKay about why he didn't support public education. And his initial response to me was, "Hey, man, I voted for the BSA." And my response was, "Yeah, man, but you didn't vote for the veto override once the governor vetoed the BSA increase." And Representative McKay's response was, "You wanted me to override a Republican governor?" Ladies and gentlemen, that's why the House caved so quickly. This is all a setup. Those veto overrides ain't coming. But here's the problem. In the meantime, school districts are counting on the cash money they don't have. Is this a danger? Oh, hell yes. In fact, it's a big danger. Now, according to state law, a school district must send out layoff notices to teachers, pink slips, by May 1st. So if the governor drags this out and school districts continue to bank on an increase that doesn't come, there is a massive amount of liability for school districts who might end up having to pay for teachers they aren't going to use. And ladies and gentlemen, if you don't think the likelihood that Governor Dunleavy is going to veto the $680 increase per student down to $300 per student, then you've clearly missed the signs. Four things lead me to believe that Governor Mike Dunleavy will veto the education increase by over half. First, right out of the gate, the House leadership was totally comfortable committing to an increase of $77 million, or $300 per student. Second, after the House leadership introduced their $77 million proposal, Representative Craig Johnson made the comment that the governor didn't want to give public schools a dime, basically saying, look, man, be grateful for what we gave you. Third, the governor has already set the table for veto by publicly declaring the bill falls short in his mind. What did he call it? A one-sided coin. But fourth and most important, last year the governor vetoed 50% of the proposed increase at the 11th hour without giving any explanation or saying a damn word. But this year, mind you, he's offered plenty of explanations and plenty of words about his opposition, including telegraphing a veto. So why do we believe that this year he's going to acquiesce and leave the red pen in his desk? As Shakespeare said, what's past is prologue. Take care, everybody.